The Green Dragon Inn, a large Chinese restaurant not far from the Turing Institute in the city of Bletchley, was well accustomed to hosting both the celebrations of the newly emancipated and helping to drown the sorrows of recently dispossessed robot owners. There was none of the latter to be done today, though, as the huge, boisterous mob invaded the place, took over the entire second floor, and proceeded to demolish a staggering amount of dim sum. When they were done stuffing themselves, making toasts with the green tea and singing songs of triumph, "The guns are hot, the hull is ringing," the duelists and their friends adjourned to the Challenger's ample guest quarters for the night. They ended up sitting around the ship's forward lounge most of the evening, talking. Mac, mostly recovered from his flight in, but now beginning to get a little shocky with dread of the flight back, told them about his fleet refit job. He looked and sounded tired, but though hard, the work was apparently agreeing with him, because he also looked quite content. Devlin, looking relaxed and comfortable in the gray jumpsuit of an IPO Psionic Services Department cadet, told them that his training on Jirai was going quite well, and extolled the virtues of that lovely world for some time. Amanda, now that she wasn't holding herself to the brisk standard of discourse that a hearing room demanded, looked more tired than Mac. In the wake of the short war Xenia started in her last attempt to remake the succession, she explained wearily, my responsibilities have increased dramatically. Father's way of making certain I understand that my actions have consequences, she said, a bit sadly. Childhood's end is traditionally abrupt on Gamelon. Devlin raised their linked hands and kissed her knuckles. She gave him a grateful smile and said nothing for a moment, then went on. At any rate, I'm being groomed for a new position in the service of the Empire, a new learning experience. I can't tell you anything more about it just now, but I think you'll all find it interesting, she said with a wry smile. They pressed her to reveal the mystery, but of course she wouldn't, and the conversation drifted to other things before, with a large round of hugs and good to see yous, the group broke up and scattered to bed. Before they all went their separate ways at the turbo shafts, Corwin drew Dorothy aside and took her shoulders in his hands again, smiling, his eyes a little misty. Before we go, he said quietly, I just wanted to tell you how proud I am. I think... He paused, sniffed a bit, and went on with a slightly teary grin. I think I know a little bit how Mom feels now. He wiped at his eyes with his sleeve, grinned stronger, and added, And one more thing. I don't want you to think that just because the board broke the legal link between us that you can't turn to me if you need anything. I'm not your owner, but I'll always be your friend. You always have a home in my workshop if you want it. Okay? Dorothy looked back at him with her calm, dark eyes, smiled, and said softly, Okay. Corwin? He asked. Thank you. Thank you for filing those applications, over and over, until I finally came here. Thank you for sending me to WPI. For entrusting me to Caitlin, Utina, and the others. She paused, searching for words. Timothy Wainwright built me, she finally said, but in the final analysis, I owe everything I am today to you. He was my creator, but I think in a more real sense, you are my father. And she paused again, looked down, and a touch of color came to her cheeks as she murmured, I love you. Tears spilled down Corwin's face again as he drew the robot girl into another hug. Yeah, he whispered into her auburn hair, making a sound that was half chuckle and half sob. I think I do know how Mom feels. Next morning, Moose was gone, back to Hoffman. Amanda and Devlin were gone, back to Gamelon and Jirai. Corwin and Utina were gone, back to Tomodachi, or wherever they were headed next. Miki and Azalin, though, stayed. Her business on Dantrov was done, and both were eager to get back to Gerardo and be involved in the resurrection of the old castle. On Gerardo, the summer rolled by, mostly beautiful days and clear, warm nights, and the WDF Corps of Engineers and the Duelist Society both made great strides. As the summer progressed, so did the castle. While they worked on their new home and saw it take shape around them, becoming more and more like a home every day, the duelists and the friends who were helping them were a happy lot. Of the bunch, though, none was happier than Belana Torres. After years of uncertainty about herself, her place in the universe, and her future, the runaway who had mooched an MRE in mid-May and then stayed to work it off had found her calling. Jer Johnson's act of puckish compassion had been the sort of serendipitous defining moment that, before that time, she had only read about, and not believed in at that. The result, her summer's impromptu apprenticeship to Chief O'Brien, had settled beyond the shadow of doubt what she wished for her life. Belana Torres was going to be an engineer. But first, of course, she'd need an education. This had been pointed out to her by Chief O'Brien in early July, with the Irishman's usual slightly gruff but gentle tact. "Chief," she'd asked him while they worked on restoring electrical power to the East Tower, "do you think I'd be any good at this kind of thing? For a living, I mean?" "What, engineering?" said O'Brien. "Maintenance and repair work, power systems and so forth." "Hmm," replied Belana, nodding and handing him a circuit tester. "I've been thinking about it a lot, and it's what I want to do, if you think I'd be any good at it." O'Brien looked back over his shoulder out of the access panel and grinned. "Well, for whatever one old man's opinion's worth, I think you'll make a fine engineer, once you've had a chance to get some more schooling." "Schooling? Why can't I just learn it on the job? That's what I've been doing all summer." O'Brien smiled and shook his head. "No, Belana, I'm afraid that kind of thing's long in the past. Gone are the days when a person could learn a trade through practice alone and make a living at it. There's just too much to know about things these days. Take this system, for example. If you're a real engineer at heart, you won't be content just knowing how to fix it, keep it running. You'll want to know how it works, why it works, and how you can maybe make a better one." The chief handed back the tool, snapped the access panel back in place over the conduit, and brushed off his hands, then turned to her and concluded, "That kind of thing takes schoolwork, not just hands-on experience. Experience is a wonderful thing, there's no substitute for it. But if you really want to succeed in life, stay in school and learn everything you can. You never know when anything you learn might come in handy." O'Brien chuckled at himself. "Listen to me. You can tell my wife's a schoolteacher, can't you?" Belana smiled at the jest, then sighed, looking disconsolate. "But I'm so far behind everybody else my age," she said. "My mother's family isn't big on book learning. How am I supposed to catch up now? Where can I go for something like that?" O'Brien couldn't help it. As he packed up his tools, he started laughing. Belana folded her arms and scowled at him. "What the hell's so funny about that?" she demanded. O'Brien shook his head, still chuckling, and replied, "Sorry, Belana, it's just... what a question! Look around you! Don't you realize where you are?" For the next several days, the half-Klingon girl had considered the engineer's words. Finally, a week after her conversation with O'Brien, she'd taken her concerns to Mia Ausa, operating on the possibly flawed but attractive logic that half-breeds had to stick together. As it happened, when Belana found Mia, she was sitting on the low stone wall that flanked the path from the castle down to the common, not angular enough to be a quad, talking with Chenan about matters Minbari. Belana said she didn't want to interrupt and could come back, but after both girls insisted that she wasn't disturbing anything they couldn't get back to later, she told them both her concerns. "I know Chief O'Brien meant well," she concluded, "but this place, if it's really supposed to be the reincarnation of WPI, then it's going to be way too elite for me. I haven't been to a real school since I was 6, and what they taught me on Konos isn't likely to be of any use anywhere else." She sighed. "And I don't have any money for tuition or anything. You guys have been putting me up out of charity." Chinan grinned. "You've been working your butt off to earn your keep, kid. Charity don't enter into it." Mia nodded. "I must agree. You've more than repaid the society's hospitality. Not only have you worked hard to help us with the castle, but we enjoy your company, too," she added with a smile. "As for the Institute, well, it's true that it's going to be a demanding school, but you're a very smart girl, Bilana, whether you realize it or not. Not many 12-year-old girls." "I'm 13, Bilana insisted, scowling that thundercloud scowl that made her look the most Klingon, and ironically often appeared when someone made the mistake of assuming she was a full Klingon. "Almost," she added, subsiding into a sheepish grin when Mia fixed her with a look of gentle skepticism. "Yes, well," Mia went on tolerantly, "not many almost 13-year-old girls or boys could do what you've done this summer, coming from a background of..." She paused, trying to find a way to say the next part without seeming condescending. "Benighted savagery," Bilana helpfully supplied. "I was going to say reduced opportunity, but if you insist," said Mia wryly. "At any rate, it would probably be a lot of work, but I think you could get in, with a little help from your friends." "Maybe," Bilana allowed. "But how'd I pay for it?" "The Institute is, theoretically, open to all students of promise, regardless of circumstance. Scionci is able to attend, after all, and he has very little money. The admissions department takes these things into account." "Bottom line, kid," said Chinan. "You want to go to DSM, we can make it happen. All you have to do is want it bad enough." Just like that, the Duelist Society had another project. In the days, they worked on the castle, and after dinner, they banded together to prepare Bilana Torres for the DSM admission test. As many of the duelists, including the entire Sephirian contingent, had been required by their lack of previous school records to test into WPI the previous year, they knew what to expect. And so the bulk of the coaching fell to them, with encouragement, moral support, and caffeine being provided by the rest. Miki Kaworu, ever keen to aid in the intellectual growth of anyone, threw himself into the effort with considerable fervor. So did Dorothy, out of an affinity for another being striving to carve out her own place in a universe that had its own ideas of her purpose. Mia's own commitment to the project could be traced to a very similar notion, and the very supportive note Bilana had received from Utena Tenjo when she'd been informed of the project in one of Caitlin's letters was motivated by that same idea as well. It was hard going, but the young girl had never felt so firmly supported in all her life, and she was damned if she wasn't going to make it. Number 402, The Castle, DSM Memorial Institute, Gerardo, RB, Centauri Sector 4492, Sunday, August 7th, 2405. Utena Tenjo, care of Scold Ravenhair, 71 Technology Avenue, Nikomikoka, Tomodachi, Rigel Sector, 1609. My darling Utena, writing an old-fashioned letter this way seems like a silly thing to do in this day and age, but with you off skylarking around the galaxy with your young gentleman, this is probably more reliable than calling. At least I know that when you get back from... Where did Corwin's mom say you were going? Enigma X-21? Sounds exciting. You'll find this waiting for you. Things here are busy, but mainly under control. We've got about 2/3 of the castle habitable. Chief O'Brien and B'Elanna got the fusion reactor working last weekend, so we've got actual lights at night and everything. It's fast losing that rustic feeling we had when we first started camping here and starting to feel like an actual home. By the time you get back, it should be just about perfect. And I bet it still won't have a real name. 20 credits says it just ends up being The Castle forever and ever. Speaking of B'Elanna, she passed the entrance exam and it looks like she'll be getting a scholarship to come to school this fall. She'll be in the class of 2409. She's still nervous about her family finding her and dragging her back to Kronos, but not so much now that she's been going to taco night on Krontep's ship most weekends. She's loosened up about the whole Klingon thing, too. I guess hanging around with Professor Krolg and getting to know Krontep and his crew has made her realize that there's more than one way to be a Klingon. She's starting to take an interest in that funny sword thing Krolg uses, the what's it called? Bat something. You know the thing I mean. I think we might have another duelist on our hands before too long. Last Friday, we finally got the new ceiling finished in the dojo. Tomorrow we start painting the walls. It's really shaping up. We christened it Friday night with a series of practice duels. Juries started studying Scrang's saber techniques from Sai. She hauled out some new move he taught her and just about gaffed poor Miki. He wasn't expecting it at all. Kate whipped up on Sionji, of course, but he's getting better. He and I draw about half the time and split the others pretty much even. You're going to love the room Kate picked for you two. 501, the West Tower. Sure, you have to climb down a flight of stairs to get to the bathroom, but the view from up there is worth it, trust me. If the weather's right, you get a midnight view of Bajor that's just to die for. The only problem is going to be getting two people's worth of furniture to fit right in a round room. Kate says she's thinking about designing it all from scratch. Chenan says she has some ideas. If you want to have any say at all, you'd better email them quick. The rest of the school is coming along great, too. Major Clanton says they have 90% of the facilities work done and 95% of the buildings raised, with interior work proceeding at a very satisfactory rate. You know how he talks. The roads are all done, and they're starting to put in the landscaping around the buildings that are done on the outside. It still looks nowhere near done, but you can start to see what it'll look like when it is done, and I think it's going to be really, really nice. There's a lot of open space and green, and a lot of marble and white stone. It'll be a lot more like Otori than WPI was, but in a good way, I think. Say what you like about the old place, it was pretty. Now that Moose is back, he got in last night, Kate's trying to put her band back together. Miki's willing to take a shot at rhythm guitar, but she's still looking for a drummer. I think Sionji ought to try it. He'd look cool on stage. But he claims to have no rhythm. I think he's just shy. Last night at dinner, while Kate was talking about it, Ezalin got that evil I have a plan look she gets sometimes. I shudder to imagine what she's up to, but we'll probably find out soon. Well, I suppose I should close now. Sionji doesn't look like he has anything important to do, so I'm going to make him rub my back. Hope your space training is going well and you and Corwin aren't doing anything too crazy, like asteroid racing or picking fights with Elossi pirates. If you go off and get atomized while I sit around here in the lap of luxury, the magic midget will kill me. Write back if you get the time. We won't have phones in the castle for at least another week. With everlasting love, I remain your enraptured servant, Wakaba. August poised itself on the precipice and dove toward September, taking everyone with it in an accelerating plunge toward the beginning of a new school year. Suddenly it seemed as if there would never be enough time for the Corps of Engineers to get everything they needed to do done in time for the start of the school year. The pace of construction seemed to take on a hectic edge, with things made all the more congested and confused by the arrival of the full administration in early August. There was a reason the Corps of Engineers had built the administration building first. Then the faculty started arriving, buying homes in Port Gerardar and getting acclimated. Parents and students started coming in twos and threes to look over the place and consider. Then, in the third week of August, it all coalesced, so fast that no one really noticed that it was happening until it was over. The Corps of Engineers finished their work, packed up their things, cleaned up their mess, and moved on to the next job. and in their wake, where there had once been wilderness, they left a complete campus. 2 dozen buildings, roads, athletic facilities, equestrian and walking trails, support facilities, landscaping, parklands, the works. With the beautiful summer weather showing no signs of abating just because August was winding down, the school complete and coming to life around them, and the castle's renovation all but complete, the duelists and their friends were blissfully content. The 2 weeks that remained now until the start of term would be spent in pure leisure, with all the hard work behind them and no responsibilities other than to enjoy that labor's fruits until classes began. At least, that was the plan until the admissions department did a slightly too helpful thing. Utena Tenjo had never been so happy to be going back to school before. Oh, she'd enjoyed her summer every bit as much as she'd expected she would. More. But the approaching term had a very pleasant flavor to it as she disembarked from the one-hit wonder at Port Jaredar in the mid-afternoon of Thursday, the 25th of August. Her Republic of Zeta Cygni Starship Master's certificate was tucked into her wallet, right next to her Avalon County driver's license. Bahava El was shining bright, and birds were singing as she lounged in the passenger seat of Corwin's Black Griffin and watched the sunlight sparkle off the breeze-chopped surface of Lake Jaredar. Corwin glanced across the car at her and grinned. He knew just the mood she was in. What the hell, he ought to. He was in it himself. "You did good," he told her for the 100th time. "Couldn't have without you," she replied for the 100th time. They grinned at each other. "I'm surprised you didn't apply for the Institute this fall yourself," Utena observed after a few moments. "You're smart enough, for sure." On her shoulder, Nall snickered. "Not suicidal enough, though," he said. "Thanks," said Corwin wryly. "But the furball's right. There's about a dozen people would wring my neck if I didn't show up at Koopman High next week. If Buttercup and her sisters didn't get me, Len or Ochka would." He grinned easily. "Besides, if I came here, then I wouldn't have anywhere to go on the weekends." She chuckled and admitted he had a point, and the next moment they crested the lakeshore rise, and there was the campus, a green-fringed expanse of buildings, walkways, and trees where there had previously been only thick forest. "Wow," said Utena, Nall, and Corwin together. And in the corner, standing proud on the hill in the northwest corner of the campus like a sentinel, was the angular, four-towered, center-domed shape of the duelist's castle, seeming to preside over the campus from one side and Lake Jaredar from the other. It was the first part of the school to come into view from the road from Port Jaredar, regal and lonely on its hilltop but for the single huge Bajoran maple tree that stood near the main entrance. There were two duelists sparring on the roof, their weapons catching the sunlight as they fought back and forth between the crenellated ramparts and the shining bronze dome. Atop the dome was a flagpole, and flying from that flagpole, Utena laughed when she saw it, was a white flag with the scarlet rose seal of the Duelist Society. They pulled to a stop in the visitor's parking lot next to the common, disembarked, and started following the nicely flagstone path up the hill to the castle, admiring its cleaned exterior and shiny new windows. Utena got another pleasant surprise. The big round window over the main entrance, which had been an empty hole when they found the place, had been filled with a large stained-glass representation of the rose seal as well. "Himemia will like that," she thought to herself. "We've taken that symbol and made it stand for something good and proud." The main doors were unlocked, the great hall deserted. Calling out hellos, the two crossed the hall and went through the archway to what Kate's initial assessment had guessed was probably supposed to be a ballroom, to be used as a dojo under the duelist regime. This was a large room, about double the size of the gymnasium back at WPI, with no furniture or impedimenta of any kind. Since Corwin and Utena had seen it last, it had been stripped to the bare walls and painted white, which, along with the high windows, made the place seem flooded with light. Off to one side, what looked like most of the Duelist Society and several others, Moose McEachern's unmistakable bulk was there, and the bald and mottled form of Jacron, stood in an angry defensive knot, confronted by two large men in gray and black armor. "What the hell?" wondered Utena. She and Corwin crossed the dojo to join the group. Kate, standing at the forefront with her arms folded and her eyes angry, noted Utena's arrival and gave her roommate a small, tight smile, then returned her attention to the interlopers immediately. They were both Klingons, both bulky and imposing. Utena realized with a shock that she recognized one of them. The one with the more ornate armor and the cape was Zarg Thalak, late of Captain Kronteb's crew and now the Klingon ambassador to Babylon 5. She didn't know the other one, although by his expensive-looking armor and gold-studded batleth, she took him to be a warrior of fairly high standing. This one, the younger, rather ugly one, was brandishing a white letter envelope and ranting at Caitlin. "Letter of congratulation! Congratulation that a daughter of our house has been chosen to waste her time and our money at this soft, human school, rather than learning her proper place among her own kind. The irony borders on insult!" Utena, scowling, stepped up to the man, put a hand on his chest, and shoved him back a couple of feet. She and Corwin flanked Kate, adding themselves to the human wall blocking whatever it was Kate was blocking. "Who the hell are you?" she demanded, "and why are you yelling at our president?" The Klingon caught himself, straightened, and glared venomously at Utena. "What right have you, child, to presume to lay a hand on me?" Utena put her fists on her hips, standing shoulder to shoulder with Kate, and replied flatly, "I'm a duelist. That's all the right I need in this castle. You want to try it again from the top? I'm listening." "He's my Uncle Clavor," said B'Elanna Torres from behind Utena. "The admissions department found out Mother's address and mailed her a congratulation letter when I passed the admissions test. I tried to tell him that it won't cost them anything, but he won't listen." Utena glanced back at her. "And now he's here to take you home?" B'Elanna nodded miserably. "And you don't want to go?" asked Corwin. B'Elanna shook her head miserably. Utena faced front, fixing the Klingon's beady black eyes with her narrowed royal blue ones. "Then you don't go," she and Corwin said together, which brought a faint smile of mingled amusement and satisfaction to Kate's cold, hard face. "You have nothing to say about it, girl," snapped Clavor. "As the head of the House of Clavar, I have the right to reclaim my sister's daughter. She is here without my permission or her mother's, and under Klingon law she cannot remain if I wish to take her home. Is that not correct, Ambassador Zarg?" Zarg nodded. "That is correct, Clavor." He turned his stony face to Utena. "If the Vistai Kalan has taught you anything of our ways, Captain Tenjo, you know this to be true." "Where the hell is Professor Krog?" Corwin whispered to Miki Kaworo. "Miss Jury's gone to look for him," Miki replied. At Zarg's words, Clavor's eyebrows rose, and then he burst out laughing. "This girl child, a captain?" he demanded, almost convulsed with mirth. "First the one who cannot speak blocks my path, and now this..." Here, standard failing him, Clavor used a Klingon word, best translated perhaps as cupcake. "Court's a lesson in manners, and you call her a captain? In whose fleet? The Federation Campfire Scouts?" "Oh, just push that button, why don't you, pal?" said Nall in a delighted murmur. Zarg gave his countryman a warning look, which Clavor utterly missed, and said stiffly, "The Sutai Tenjo has defeated Krog Vistai Kalan and Griffin of the IPO in single combat. The one standing next to her is a teaching master of one of the humans' deadliest ways of combat. You would do well to treat both with respect." "I don't believe it," said Clavor, incredulous. "Is the one calling me a liar?" Zarg inquired, his voice dangerously calm. "Of course not, honored ambassador," replied Claivor smoothly. "It is merely surprising." Belana's uncle regarded Uthrina and Kate with a more appraising look that was still something of a sneer. "At any rate, it's moot. The girl belongs with her family, and I am taking her. If you interfere with me, well, that's why I brought the ambassador with me," he added with a jagged-toothed smile. "You wouldn't want to cause an international incident in the shadow of your precious Babylon station, would you, girls?" Utna flushed and started to retort, but then someone pushed her aside, and Mia Ausa shouldered her way to the front, shoving the Klingon back another 2 feet just by striding forward until she stood in the place where he had been standing. "My name is Mia, of the House of Ausa," she informed him coldly. "In the name of Kalis, I challenge you." Claivor raised an eyebrow. "Is this a joke?" he demanded, no more amusement in his bearing. "You dare invoke the revered name of Kalis the Unforgettable in a schoolgirl's jest?" "No joke, Claivor Vestai Clavar," Mia replied. "I say that you are in the wrong, and I invite you to put the matter in the right hand of Kalis." "And what is your special qualification?" inquired Claivor mockingly. "If this one is a samurai master and this one is a captain, I suppose you are the child of a god." Corwin suppressed an entirely inappropriate snicker. Nall didn't bother, but nobody paid him any attention. "I am Anla Shock," said Mia flatly. "Will you accept my challenge, or will you hide behind letters and laws like a coward?" Claivor's hatchet face distorted with anger. "You dare!" He stepped back, reached over his shoulder, and whipped his gold-accented batleth into position. "So be it!" he roared. "Anla Shock! The Anla Shock are a joke known even on Kronos! Come and learn the folly of calling a Klingon warrior coward, child!" "Hold it," said Caitlin sharply. You fight between our walls?" "Then you fight by our rules," Uthrina finished for her, and Kate nodded firmly. Miki nodded, went to the next room, and returned with a pair of roses, aqua for Mia and red for the interloper. Dorothy did the honors while Uthrina explained the rules. The Klingon snorted derisively. "Children's games," he scoffed. Utina's azure eyes went glacial and gave Claivor a look that left him, even in his arrogant and angry state, slightly unsettled. "We'll see," she said, and then turned and left them to it. Mia regarded him coolly for a moment, then reached into her demicoat and drew her Minbari battle staff. The rest of the duelists moved back, all but holding their breath, as Zarg stepped aside, his long, hard face set in an expression of resignation. As soon as the battlefield was clear, Claivor bellowed and charged. Mia knew she couldn't face him strength for strength. She was surprisingly strong for a girl her age and size, a legacy from her Minbari mother, but Claivor was a full-grown male Klingon, and, though not quite the size of Professor Krolg or his cousin Klang, who was big even for a Klingon, of formidable stature. But then, she didn't have to face him with just her own strength, did she? "Molten core at the heart of the world," she chanted softly as she circled back from his initial feints and kept his blade at bay with her staff. "Relentless, restless strength, power that can shatter mountains. Heed the will of she who calls and lend to her your strength. Geosurge!" Orange light surrounded her, gushing up from the floor as if a lava vent had opened beneath her. Her long black hair and her brownish-green ranger robes snapped in a brief but violent wind as the light swirled around her, vaguely reminiscent of a Klingon transporter's energy bleed. Then it dissipated, and as Claivor took a half-step back with widened eyes and asked no one in particular what the hell it had been, Mia sprang forward and jabbed the butt of her staff into his solar plexus. Claivor staggered, breath gushing out of him, and Mia pressed her advantage. The boost of strength and speed that Geosurge bestowed didn't last long, but she could feel it coursing through her and exulted in it. It was much more powerful here on Gerardo than it had been on ancient, cooling Minbar. Despite its civilization's great age, Bajor was a young world as worlds go, and its moon was its contemporary, with the tremendous heat and pressure of planetary formation still seething in its liquid core. While she rode the wave of power and battered Claivor, Mia considered other spells she might use. Many of the ones she knew were of no particular use, since she didn't want to kill the man. Chain lightning, for example, would have been eminently satisfying, but it would probably also have barbecued Bilana's uncle, which, even if the girl didn't like him, seemed a bit extreme. Presently the Geosurge ebbed. Claivor seemed to sense it, and went back on the offensive, hammering at her defenses and chasing her all around the room. Mia drew on every bit of her training and experience, remembering all those sessions with her uncle Devon and his fellow rangers, the tips and tricks of millennia of fighting heritage, and the tidbits she'd learned since becoming a duelist. You wouldn't think that there would have been much for her to learn, being the only staff fighter in the society proper, Corwin's membership being honorary, but having faced Professor Krog several times now, she knew a thing or two about fighting a man with a batleth, and now it all came into focus. Twice she came within a hair's breadth of relieving Claivor of his rose. Twice he turned her strike at the last moment, then rattled her teeth with his counterattack. The second time she realized what she'd been doing wrong. The third time she corrected it, and scarlet petals scattered onto the white stone floor of the dojo. Her battle won, Mia stepped back and squared herself. She opened her mouth to speak, and Claivor, roaring, charged, one gleaming point of his batleth reaching for her heart. Standing in the archway from the entrance hall, Juri Arisugawa and Professor Krog stared in horror, then lunged almost as one, reaching for their weapons. "Son of a!" Utrina cried, the thorn of the rose already in her hand as she leaped. Corwin was right behind her, stick appearing in his hands with a crack like thunder. Caitlin had already vanished, her hand closing on Kotetsu no Sasiaki's grip as she flickered from sight. Behind them, the other duelists surged forward as one, and every last one of them would be too late to save their friend. Mia saw him coming, felt time stretch, and invoked the only source of power she could think of off the top of her head. "Nall!" she cried, her voice high and clear. "Lend me your power!" "Wah!" cried Nall, his little red eyes glowing like coals, hackles standing on end. For the merest heartbeat, it seemed as though the spectral form of a gigantic snow-white beast hovered over Mia, and Claivor was flung violently backward, slamming into the far wall with a sickening thud. The metal, one of the hardest alloys known to Klingon metallurgy, had been frozen so cold by whatever had turned it away from Mia Aus's breast that it broke like glass on the hard stone floor. Claivor Vestai Clavar slid slowly down the wall and crumpled into a sitting position, his wide-open eyes blank with shock. "Well," said Zarg Thalek dryly, "that would appear to be a clear victory." He stepped to the side of his fallen countryman, towed the fragments of Claivor's ruined batleth aside, and said in complete seriousness to Mia, "Will you have his life?" Mia stood looking down at the man who had just tried to murder her for a moment, then said, "I don't want it," turned and walked away. Claivor shook his head, struggled to his feet. "Wait," he said. "Ambassador, surely you don't intend to let this stand. Interstellar law!" Zarg turned, slowly, drew himself up to his full height, which was at least 2 inches above Claivor's, and took a deep breath, expanding his barrel chest impressively. His face was a mask of offended dignity. "You were challenged in the name of Kaelis," he informed Claivor in a low, dangerous voice. "Do you now ask me to reverse the outcome of a battle which was fought in his right hand? You accepted the challenge and were fairly defeated. The girl Belana is no longer of your house, Vestai Clavar. She belongs to the duelists now.
But that's absurd,
Clavor protested, starting to regain his strength.
The girl, the Anlashok, she cheated! Some kind of trick! Look at my weapon! It cannot...
Zarg's face took on a look of intense distaste. The one is whining, he said, his tone colder still. The one is wasting my time. He folded his arms. This matter is now concluded. You will return to your home and inform your sister of your failure. Any further attempt to remove the girl Belana from this place will be unlawful. Then the Honorable Ambassador from Kronos smiled a cold little smile and added, his voice dripping with scorn, You wouldn't want to cause an international incident in the shadow of my precious Babylon station, would you? Beaten, his shoulders slumping, Clavor gathered his ruined weapon and left the castle without looking back. Zarg watched him go, then turned to regard the duelists. Kai Kasai, well fought, Mia Sutai Ausa, he said. Then he repeated for their benefit, This matter is now concluded. Turned, and left the castle as well. Huh, said Utrina. Maybe that guy's not the total loser I took him for. Mia retracted her staff, put it away, and then turned, smiling. Thank you, Nol, she said. You saved my life.
What the heck did you do?
Utrina demanded.
I called upon Nol's power to protect me, Mia replied, as if it were as simple as tuning a radio. He's a white great dragon, after all. They're powerful protectors.
She reached and scruffled the little dragon, adding apologetically, I'm sorry I had to do it without asking first, though.
S all right, Nol replied with a weak little feline grin. Heh, I never been invoked before, he added with a slightly dreamy tone in his voice.
Really? Well, I'm honored to have been your first, she said, bowing.
Was it good for you too? Said Nol, and he fell asleep. Belana? Is Belana still here?
Mia asked the assembled group, and from out of their midst came Belana Torres, looking a bit overwhelmed and teary-eyed.
Belana, what's wrong? Mia asked.
The half-Klingon girl stood looking at her for a moment, then burst into tears and seized the half-Minbari girl in an embrace.
Well, said Utrina wryly, scratching at the back of her head. This has been an eventful homecoming. How's everybody doing? I passed, if anybody's curious.
Well then, said Moose McEachern with a broad grin, I guess we've got three things to celebrate tonight.
What's the second one?
Why, your home, of course, Moose told her.
Corwin took them all up to Babylon 5 for dinner at the newly opened Marché Mövenpick, where they took over one of the long Oktoberfest-style tables and made good on Moose's prediction of a treble celebration. The duelists and their friends whiled away the evening eating, drinking, proposing toasts, telling jokes, and swapping stories of their summer's adventures.
"Professor Krolg?" asked Belana at one point.
"Yes, Miss Torres," replied Krolg kindly.
"Will you show me how to fight like my uncle did?"
Except for the whiny, sore loser part, Utrina interjected.
Yeah, except for that, Belana added with a grin.
Certainly, Krolg said. I admit to some surprise that you would choose the Batleth, though, he went on. It is, after all, such a quintessentially Klingon weapon.
Belana considered that, then smiled.
Nothing's perfect, she said. And the professor roared with laughter.
Indeed, he declared,
Kai Torres, Kai the Philosopher.
And then splash! Wakaba Shinohara was chortling at the other end of the table. Right into the lake!
I seem to have spent a great deal of time falling into the lake this summer, Sayanji agreed serenely.
In the old days, said Kate mildly, they did balance training over hot coals, but,
she added sadly, salting her mashed potatoes,
we can't do it that way anymore,
she sighed.
Insurance.
Dorothy's your new drummer? Said Corwin.
She's damn good, Moose replied. Precise, powerful, and passionate at the same time. It's almost like having Devlin back.
No one could replace Devlin, said Dorothy modestly. I only aspire to succeed him.
So who succeeds Amanda? Wondered Corwin.
Her eldest son or daughter, presumably, said Azalin, causing Corwin to give her a look.
Mackenzie should be back with us in time for the start of classes, said Jacron.
Mac is Amanda's replacement?
No, said Jacron. What? I was talking to Skaya.
Oh. Sorry.
Actually, said Miki, I've been trying rhythm guitar myself. With Azalin's help, I may yet become acceptable.
He triggered his watch, frowned at it, and started it again.
Amanda is a tough act to follow, though. She's extremely talented.
Well, I'm glad you think so, said Amanda Dessler, bringing the table-wide conversation to a thunderous halt. The silence lasted several seconds.
What? Said Rena Dragonar with a grin.
Amanda, said Kate, rising.
Rena, you came for the opening ceremonies?
In a manner of speaking, said Amanda, smiling dryly.
You may remember back in June, I mentioned that Father was giving me new responsibilities to expand the scope of my experiences for the day when I take over from him.
Yeah, said Utina.
Well, Amanda went on, tossing back some of her long, lacquer-black hair with a negligent gesture and smiling, Father has just signed the Pact Babylonica.
Kate took that in, blinked, blinked again, and said slowly,
You mean...
Rena grinned, came to attention, and announced, All rise for Her Excellency Amanda Electra Dessler, Ambassador from the Empire of Gamelon.
Airy Productions Unlimited presented Undocumented Features, Future Imperfect, Symphony of the Sword No. 2, First Movement, This Old Dorm. The symphony will return with Blue Moon Serenade.